history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories that need to be told. And sometimes if we just take the time to ask a few questions and listen a little bit, we will be amazed by what some of our elder statesmen have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today we're in Coronado, California, where if you say Hometown Heroes, maybe there's a few people who listen to the radio on 1170 and 1210 down here and listen to the program every weekend. But in Coronado, if you say Hometown Heroes, people think about the banners that line the streets here. And if you're on the corner of 3rd and J, you're going to see a Hometown Hero banner with a picture of Richard Hayward on it. And we're going to hear Mr. Hayward's story today. It involves the Army in World War II, 20 years as an Air Force chaplain, and a whole lot of twists and turns that we're going to try to cover in the time we have today. But Mr. Hayward, let's start early on. You grew up in Michigan.
Yeah, Pawpaw, Michigan is where I really grew up. I was 9 years old, and the newspapers were publishing newspapers at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then another one at noon. And I always worked for the guys with the noon paper so that I could go to school in the morning. And my parents, my dad came directly from England and didn't have any idea about America. And my mother was from a small family up in New England, and she didn't have any money. And they both went to college when I went to grade school, and they went through their college, 5 years of college, and then they decided to change to Mount Clemens. They owed the college $900, and I had saved $900, so I paid for their college.
From your paperboy money.
Paperboy money.
How many kids can claim they paid for both their parents' college with paperboy money? That's quite a story in itself. And that small town where you were living before, what was the name of it?
Pawpaw. P-A-W, P-A-W.
How big a place was that?
Oh, it was just a small town. It was at 18 miles from Kalamazoo. They used to go to Kalamazoo College, and they'd drive up there and go to college, and then I'd go to grade school. I kept the newspaper routes all the way through high school. But then the war started. I had graduated from high school in 1941. The war began. They only accepted people that were 20 years or older, and my mother said to me, I'm never going to sign anything for you to go to war, so just forget it. And then they took me to a small college where they thought it'd be nice for me to go through while the war was going on. And that college, I saw a sign that said, join the ARC. And I said, what's that ARC thing? And they said, oh, that's the Army Reserve Corps. I said, how do you join it? He says, every Wednesday night you go to a meeting for 4 years, and then you become a second lieutenant in the Army when you graduate. And I said, but there must be some way to get in the war. And the guy says, yeah, they've got a little clause in there that says, in case of a national emergency, the ARC will be called into active duty immediately. And of course, we were already in the war. So I said, give me that application. I took it home, and then I said to my mom, look, you don't have to worry about me. I'll be in an Army thing every Wednesday night, so you don't have to worry about me going to war. And she bought it, and she signed it. Then I turned it in, and then I went to war. I went to basic training 13 weeks in down in Texas.
Right away?
Yeah.
Well, what did your mother say when she realized you were heading off to basic training?
She couldn't do anything about it because it was all down black and white, and she'd signed it.
You pulled a fast one on her.
Yeah, I did. And she was mad at me, but that's all right. I wanted to go to war. And then I had some fun at the basic training. The sergeant would get us up out of bed in the morning and say, okay, we're going on a 5-mile hike before breakfast. And so we'd go full field pack for 5 miles and so forth. And then one time we had to learn to fire the rifle. They have us in groups of five down at the rifle range, and we had our target that we fired at. And then the sergeant came down and said, "Now, you guys have to realize that after you get through firing the rifle, you have to clean it before you can go to town." So I got the other four guys together and said, "Hey, let's all fire the same rifle, and then everybody can go to town except the guy that's got the rifle, and we'll change it from day to day so that everybody gets a chance at it." And then the sergeant realized what I was doing, and he says, "Hey, I'll make you my assistant, if you will, and you can stay right here and stay on the cadre and train the men going overseas." And I said, "I didn't join the Army to spend it in Texas."
Why did you join the Army? Why was it so important for you to pull a fast one on your mom and get in uniform?
Because I knew that our country needed us, and we needed somebody to go to war, and I was ready to do it.
But you're down there, and they say, "Hey, you can stay here, and you can just train the guys," and you say, "No, I want to go overseas."
Yeah, and they said, you're crazy, and they kept telling me that. But after about 2 or 3 weeks, they finally put me on orders to go to the South Pacific, and so I went to the South Pacific. Then I came into the 32nd Division. I was on the front lines for about 220 days total, I think, but it was over 2 or 3 years, I guess. The one time that really was horrible was when they got a machine gun and got it up above us. We were in our foxholes, and a foxhole is something different. The enemy's side of the foxhole, you dig a deep hole there where you can stand up and fire out in front of you. Then behind it, about 2 feet under the ground, we had a level place where we could sleep. We had to have somebody was guard duty every night. If he thought there was somebody out there, he'd touch our leg, and then we'd grab our rifles and jump down there ready to fire. It was kind of amusing after the war, because these guys went back and they married these gals back in the United States, and then the gal would touch their leg at night, and boy, everything went crazy.
Well, and you said that one time that was really bad, and I understand what I've read about you, thanks to the Avenue of Heroes here in Coronado and how they've honored you. In their description of your service, they said among those 220 days that you were on the front lines, there were 4 times that you should have been killed or wounded.
Yeah.
Well, tell me this. What was your welcome to the war moment? What was the first thing that you encountered over there?
Well, we went to a secure island there in the Pacific. The native there, he saw me, and there was a big oxen with big horns on it, and he put me up on it and took a picture of me. And so that was my first picture on the front lines.
And you have that picture here in your home in Coronado, and I'll put it on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. Everybody can see it.
Yeah.
But that's not combat yet. Where did you see your first combat? Is this in the Philippines?
It was in the Philippines. We fought up the Villa Verde Trail. And I was a rifleman. I was on the front lines,
From day to day, I mean, how do you prepare yourself for going into that kind of combat under those kind of conditions and that kind of weather against that kind of enemy?
Well, one thing, the weather was always good because it was hot, and I loved hot weather.
Coming from Michigan, I bet that was different
for you. So that was okay for me. And we always dug our foxholes in a circle so that we would all be firing out at the enemy. And sometimes the guy would, at night, would fall asleep, and then the Japs would come in and with their big knives and cut these guys up, and, I mean, kill them all. And
you saw that happen or saw the aftermath?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that doesn't give you much encouragement or solace when you're going to sleep at night.
I understand that, but that's what we did. We had to do it.
Well, let me ask you this, because your story is an Army story and an Air Force story, but it's also a story about your faith.
Oh, yeah.
And faith became your life's work as a chaplain and later a pastor. But when you went overseas, was that a big part of your life?
Oh, yeah. That was a big part of my life. My dad was in the First World War. He was born and raised in England. And after the war, England didn't have any jobs for these guys. And so he wrote a letter to a guy in Canada and another guy in Michigan. Said, you got any jobs over there? The guy in Canada says, if you're getting 3 square meals a day in England, stay there. And the guy in Michigan said, pack your bag and come on over because Henry Ford is hiring today. That was Ford Factory. So he came over and started working at Ford Factory, and then he ran into my mother, and she was a very religious gal. She wanted him to be a pastor like his father was. So she got him a little church here at Pawpaw, Michigan, with the idea that he could go to, that they both could go to college in the mornings, and they had every morning off so they could go to college.
So your dad did become a pastor.
Oh, yeah.
So this was in your blood.
Not only that, but my mother became a pastor, and that was back in the 1930s when women weren't pastors, you know.
Yeah.
And the big deal there was the blacks and the whites, you know, they didn't have churches together. They would be on separate churches. And she became the first pastor of a church in Lawrence, Michigan. And I went to church with the blacks and whites together. And this was one of the most wonderful things, I think, that happened. And I have a picture on my wall in my bedroom that I wake up every morning and see this picture of this church and remember that my mother was on the leading edge of that. And they really gave her a grilling when she wanted to be ordained, because they didn't want her being ordained. And they had about 6 or 7 ministers. They gave her all the questions they could think of, oral questions, for her to answer. And finally, after about 3 or 4 hours of doing this, one of the old guys says, well, what are we going to do with her? And the other guy says, you're going to ordain her. That's all there is to it. So they did. They ordained her. And she had this one church, and Dad had the other church.
So your two parents pastored different churches in different towns.
Yeah.
How about that? How many people can tell that story? And what I hear you saying is that your mother's church in Lawrence, Michigan was the first racially integrated church there.
Yeah.
How about that? What a legacy. Yeah. So when you went overseas, you had this belief that God was going to protect you? Or that if you were supposed to die, you would?
My dad gave me the 91st Psalm, and he said, read this psalm and be sure to do what it says there. And the 91st Psalm is where it says, trust in the Lord and he'll take care of you, and he'll take his angels and they'll come down and make sure that you're not bothered in the nighttime, and in the daytime the arrows will not fly your way, and maybe 1,000 will die in thy right side and 1,000 on the left side, but you will not be harmed. And so when I got into this horrible time when everybody's getting killed, I prayed and said, God, take care of me. I'm your man, living, dying, whatever. And then I went into a deep sleep. And when I woke, there was a bright sunshine and the guys were eating, and I was feeling pretty darn good. And God's been with me ever since.
And wow. And we're going to hear some of those examples of what makes you believe that. In your division, the 32nd Infantry Division, actually saw more days in combat in the Pacific than any other American outfit in the war. You weren't there for all of it. You got there. The island you were talking about where you are riding that ox is Morotai, right before you guys got involved in the Battle of Leyte in November of 1944. So here you are, a rifleman. In close combat with a determined enemy. And you said, you claim that 91st Psalm where it says, 1,000 may fall on one side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it won't come near to you.
That's right.
So give me some examples of where it came really close to you but didn't get you.
Well, one place I was standing next to a tree, and I just stepped aside, and at that moment, a bullet went in the tree right where I was standing, you know. Another time, a grenade didn't go off. It's supposed to, but it didn't go off, you know. And
how close to you?
Oh, just a few feet from me at that time. So, you know, just one of those things. And God was with me from that time on, all the way through my life. And he's been doing things for me. And when I became a chaplain, and my very first base that I had, I was a chaplain on. They needed a chaplain at the hospital at 8 o'clock at night. I went there, and their whole family was there. There was about 6 or 8 people, and the mother was in a coma. I had prayer with them, and I looked and saw this mother in a coma. And so I went, I thought to myself, after I finished praying with them, I went down, took her hand, and prayed for her, and told God to heal her. And then I left, and the next week I came back to the hospital, and I wondered who they'd put in her room. And I went in, and I said, I'm Chaplain Hayward. And she says, you're the chaplain that prayed for me. I heard your prayer, and I also heard God say he's going to heal me. And he did.
Wow.
That was amazing to me.
Amazing to a lot of people, I'm sure, especially to her. It's time for our first break, but there's more to come with 94-year-old Richard Hayward of Coronado, California. When we come back, more of his World War II experiences with the 32nd Infantry Division and a deeper taste of his commitment to others. He's a pretty gifted writer, too, and I'm guessing you've never gotten a Christmas letter quite like the one I'm going to have him read for us when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.